Committee on Human Services on today, Monday, February 6, 2012, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order. I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 4084, and we will be holding that over until Wednesday, February 8th at 5 p.m. We'll have a joint hearing with the Judiciary Committee in Hearing Room F.
House, just to make sure.
House, thank you. And with that, unless there's any objection, we will close the work session on House Bill 4084. And we will be having, it's noticed for a hearing, but we will be having open for a hearing, but hopefully we won't have a hearing, on 4077, and we will be having a work session on 4077, and now we'll open up a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4083. And colleagues, if you remember, we've had a couple of hearings on this issue. It's regarding the Oregon State Lottery Commission asking them to adopt policies to mitigate public harms associated with lottery games, marketing practices, and retail regulations at the request of the Oregon State Lottery. With that, Representative Kennemer, could you come up? Thank you. Thank you, Representative, for all the work you've done on this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, Madam Chair, and Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. I want to thank you very much for introducing House Bill 4083 and for the time we've spent discussing this important issue. It appears that this little bill that was designed to raise consciousness about the fact that we ought to think about the implications of addicting 67,000 Oregonians more thoroughly than we currently do, and maybe we need to accept the acknowledge the reality that the Oregon legislature is also addicted to the Oregon lottery, its proceeds, and we're doing harm to our people. And it's our responsibility as policy makers to figure out what the balance is. Certainly, we're not going to eliminate gambling from the world. Certainly, we cannot rid the world of all addictions. But we need to do our fair and responsible part. And we've also learned maybe we can do a better job in making sure that our investments in treatment get to the right places and aren't subverted into other causes. This morning, the chairman of the lottery or the director of the Lottery Commission came by with some new concerns that have been developed apparently out of the AG's office about statutory duty of care to minimize gambling problems that our bill may have implicit in it. It's similar to the settlements that have been involved with smoking. And it raises a very serious potential for liability. So I think it's very clear that while some of us feel very strongly about the need for this little tiny bill to move forward, it probably needs more work. And we need, the chair has suggested that maybe there could be a work group or a task force. I think that's an appropriate step. We need to bring people back together. I find there's an increasing cadre of folks who understand that this is a problem that we need to address. And it is our responsibility as representatives of the people to talk about what's in our best interest. And I think we probably need to go to the next step and acknowledge that this bill is not the correct vehicle at this point, and we need to regroup and figure out how we proceed from here. And with that, if you have questions or comments, I'd love to respond.
Representative Kennemer. Representative.
Well, mine's more of a comment. Phil, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. And if we establish this or move this to a work group or whatever we're going to make it happen in the interim, I would love to lend a hand with this. Of course, this one is a near and dear to my heart, given the circumstances that happened in during the last session with a sister who had a gambling addiction to our Oregon video poker,
yes,
who committed crimes so that she could play those games, who ultimately died of a drug addiction that was kind of in tandem with the gambling addiction. And I think that we have got to find a way to look at our revenue to see how we rely on this and what the kind of the the costs that we don't get a fiscal on, which is the crime. Multnomah County says they're sitting on $100 million of uncollected restitution in their justice system. You know, the people, the woman I know in my community whose husband blew through $250,000 in our video poker and has, you know, lost her home. I look at that very seriously and say, you know, is that worth it? All the things, the good things that the lottery does, like they like to tell us, with the yep. millions of dollars of advertising, that I think we should be directing those dollars to, you know, addiction services. I don't think we need a billboard that tells us that the lottery does good things. So I want to, you know, be a person who'd be willing to work with you on that during the session. I just absolutely appreciate that you brought that forward and that you're so passionate about it. It does my heart good. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, thank you for your comments, and also I appreciate your enthusiasm, and I appreciate your willingness to share your story about your sister. It was a huge tragedy, and is an example of the very thing we're trying to avoid, and is a good example, frankly, sad good example.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kinnamura, thank you as well for bringing this forward and bringing attention to this. One of the things I think we need to look at, though, as well, it's not only just what the state gambling does, but it's gambling across the whole state, whether it's tribal casinos and everywhere else. And I think they play a part in this as well and probably should be involved in it and look at putting money up to help solve these issues, because there's a lot of people getting hurt. We can do away with video lottery, video poker, but it's still going to happen because we're only 40%. It's just going to increase the amount that goes on at the casinos. So I think when we push this along, I think that's some place that we should be looking at and get a hold of and have them chip in to support this program.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I think you make a good point, although I think our responsibility as a legislature is disproportionate. I think the statistics are between 80 and 85% of gambling-addicted people in this state are addicted to Oregon lottery. So that's the Indian casinos, for example, are about 13%. So it turns out that we are the cause of the vast bulk of this problem. And 67,000 people and the families that they represent has a gigantic impact. And, you know, our addiction to this lottery, well, it helps balance this budget in this very difficult time. But at what cost? We've had the city of West Lynn suffer substantial embezzlement, Estacada's fire district, and you go on, and a host of businesses. Several people have talked to me about the fact that they've had substantial amounts of money embezzled from their business, but for business reasons and the bad publicity, they haven't made that a public matter. So this is much more pervasive and a bigger issue even than a lot of us understand or that's commonly reported in the press where we can read about it.
Any further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time and look forward to working with you in whatever way we can. We need to rectify this problem. Thank you, Noel.
Thank you all. We have several people who have signed up to testify on this bill. Greg Hamilton, Roger Humble, is that correct? And Richard Harrison. Come on. Up. Hi. Just proceed.
Hi, my name's
identify yourself.
My name's Roger Humble. I'm an addiction counselor at Bridgeway Recovery Services. I work in a residential treatment center for problem gamblers, and I've been Bridgeway working with gamblers since 2006, and I've seen a lot of the consequences and a lot of the human cost for problem gambling for quite a few years now. And I'm really glad to see some kind of attempt by the legislature to have some kind of rules, or, you know, some kind of committee, some kind of oversight when the Oregon Lottery starts these aggressive marketing towards kids, you know, kind of try to get everybody in. And so I'm really happy that there's some kind of oversight in place to kind of check some of these marketing practices. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming today.
Mm-hmm. either one.
Yeah, my name is Richard Harrison. I'm a Bridgeway client at the present time. Of course, firsthand, you know, I've experienced the addiction end of the what's been offered as far as the Oregon Lottery, some of their gaming industry. It's been a 17-year battle. I mean, you know, it's since things have been put out there. You know, as the years have gone by, I've seen more and more, of course, addicts, you know, coming into play. And what's offered as far as, you know, the lottery puts out there for the people, you know, what's available. And what I've heard almost in concurrence with a lot of addicts is the just that, the availability. You know, if in my opinion, you know, if we rein back some of that, you know, it's like every corner, you know, there's some place you can go to gamble, to play a video lottery. You know, there's scratches almost every store. I mean, you know, it's too easy, and especially in recovery, it makes it more difficult of what you come back out. You know, you might go to some of these treatment places, get the tools you need, some ideas, you know, stop your cycle of gambling, get your mind back on the right track. You know, there's all been all kinds of research and you know, into the different aspects of it, but it's just, it's too available. I mean, it makes it very difficult.
Tell us just, sir, if you don't mind me interrupting. So tell us how you sort of got involved with problem gambling, what appealed to you, where you did your gambling, how often, what was your, how much money did you win or lose or whatever? What kind of costs was there to you and your family?
Well, I had a business of my own when I started out, freight handling. You know, I was making $750,000 a week, you know, in my pocket. You know, to me, at the time, at the age that I started, I was too young. I didn't know how to handle that type, you know, and it was, I just started playing the machines, you know.
How old were you?
I was probably, oh, geez, 17 off of 50. You figure, what, 33?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while.
Okay.
You know, it's took me into a lot of depths. You know, I've hit bottom and bounced quite a few times. Salvation Army knows me well. And you know, it's seen a lot of people, you know, that's gone through the same thing.
Where did you gamble?
Video lottery outlets. I mean, it's or the poker machines. Flush Fever was my favorite, but yeah, anyways. Say Flush Fever was my favorite game, but anyways, yeah. It's just, you know, I've figured up in the amount of time I've probably give a substantial amount of money, a future, you know, quarter of a million dollars probably, hard-earned money. You know, I worked in sweat. My back was sore. You know, it's something I didn't seem to be able to pull away from, even though my family and friends and everything else is falling apart around me. It, for some reason, I don't consider myself to be ignorant in any way. You know, I mean, why I couldn't stop doing this, I didn't know.
What effect did it have on your family?
Oh, it was detrimental. I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, I'm very, to this day, just for being involved with the different treatment centers and what was available out there through the years in GA, different things. I'm very thankful for that because...
That's Gambling Anonymous.
Yeah, Gamblers Anonymous. Yeah, if it weren't for those type of programs that was available at the time, I believe my sons, I'm very thankful they're not into that. You know, they've learned, they've been given the opportunity through that to be able to overcome that at this point in their life. You know, doesn't mean they're not susceptible to anything else, you know, but at this point, I'm very thankful. And that to me, I don't know, I'm becoming lost for words. It's just...
So how long have you been involved with Gambling Anonymous?
Gamblers Anonymous? Oh, I've been rambling and gambling in and out of those meetings for probably 13, 14 years.
Why is it difficult to stop that?
I learn as the treatment centers and the different organizations learn too. You know, I'm gathering information as I grow, and a lot of it has to do, I think, with behavioral patterns. You know, the way our brain operates, our all the synapses, that, you know, the routes, you know, in our decision making, you know, and then also for the amount of money, obviously, that the lottery, and, you know, they put a lot of money into their, I mean, there's documented proof, obviously, of the money that goes into what they spend on drawing people in, you know, the lights, the sounds, the, you know, things that are going to attract people and have them sit and put their life earnings into these things. I mean, it's a business, obviously. You know, they're there to make money just same as the next guy. But at some point, I feel there has to be a point where there has to be some kind of control over it. I mean, there has to be some kind of regulations. You know, there has to be some type. So you can't just have free reins to target whoever you want, to do whatever you want, with who or whatever, to who. You know, and yeah, I mean, it hurts a lot of people.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Harrison.
You.
Any questions? Mr. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of follow up where I was going with Representative Kinnamer. If the video lottery wasn't around and the casinos, would have you found yourself driving to casinos? Was your addiction at that level, or do you think the addiction would have never started?
No, I don't think so, sir. It was more because it was so readily available. Yeah. I mean, I think I drove to Spirit Mountain maybe four times, and it just wasn't the long drive back of kicking myself for, you know, once you're addicted, once you're a compulsive gambler, it doesn't matter if you win or lose. I mean, and obviously, you know, the people who have made the machines have targeted, you know, different areas. You know, it's the amount, it's the action. It's that's what you're addicted to, the dopamine, the different things that you're, it's not something you ingest that you're addicted to. It's something every one of us could be addicted to given the right circumstances.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Thank you for coming.
Hi, my name is Greg Hamilton, and I'm the Public Affairs and Religious Liberty Director for the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Oregon and a five-state region, and also President of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. In representing the church, we have had a historic strong stand against gambling for moral and economic reasons, and especially in regard to the associated crime and the victimization of communities and family breakdown and so on. So that's our main gist and has always been. For me personally, when I was born and raised in California and I met my wife-to-be, who was from Texas, and her family made a lot of trips to Las Vegas, vacation trips, and so gambling was sort of a way of life for her. She was one of 11 kids born in 11 years. And when we got married, it was funny because I was called to pastoral ministry in Nevada, of all places. And I pastored in Elko and Winnemucca, Nevada, out in the middle of nowhere. And after interviewing with the churches and being chosen as the pastor, we were at the Reno airport, and my wife just asked me if I had some extra cash because she wanted to pull some of the levers in the machines, and because she, you know, just really loved doing that. And, you know, very innocent. In the meantime, I'm on the phone talking to the conference president on how things were going, and he says, "What's your wife up to?" And I says, "Oh, you really don't want to know." And what was really funny is after we moved to Elko and Winnemucca, she saw the degradation, the lack of money that our church members have to give even to the support of their own church, many of them because of addictions. And it was very problematic. So I saw it firsthand. And if you notice, one of the things when you go to Nevada, you will notice that the church is very poor. And I mean all denominations across the spectrum. Churches are destitute. Their buildings are like shacks. They're not wealthy and big and rich. There's a few here and there in some of the big cities. But really, churches are hit real hard. So the community is hit real hard. So it's something that I noticed, and it's something that has always stayed with me. So I don't understand the Orton context really well, but I speak in behalf of the church is that we have a very serious concern, and we think that government has some responsibility to bear to help, you know, to reform and help people from not becoming so addicted. So more regulations is good.
as far as we're concerned.
Thank you. Any questions from any of these people who've come to testify today? Representative Wagner.
Can say that God probably had fun when he sent you to Elko and Winnemucca and Battle Mountain in between the two.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And it is a very desolate place, and I've done a lot of work with some of the mines out there, and some of the guys that are working in those mines ended up there where they went on jobs and they lost all their money
exactly.
at a casino, so yep. they ended up staying on working at the mine because they lost everything they had and they couldn't afford to move
That's
to
correct.
The next job.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you recognize that. Yeah, many of my church members were gold miners, and thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you all for coming today. Appreciate
thank you.
That. Good luck. That's great. Thank you. Very good, yes. Okay, we have Tim Murphy, Julie Hines, and Rhonda Hages. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Thank you for coming today.
Yeah.
Just proceed as you'd wish.
Co-Chair Samay and Co-Chair Gilliam and the rest of the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Hines. I am the Problem Gambling Prevention Coordinator with Lane County Health and Human Services. I currently sit on the National Council on Problem Gambling's Prevention Committee and am part of the four-person membership of the the Oregon Lottery Marketing Advisory Panel, which is currently having meetings. I'm here today based on a recommendation from Dr. Jeffrey Murata, as he was unable to attend today's session. And as many of you know, Dr. Murata served as a technical advisor for the sponsors of this bill. He asked me to come speak to you today as an expert in problem gambling prevention and gambling policy and be available to address or answer any questions that you might have related to this. With regard to Representative Kennemore's earlier statement, I'm not really sure what specifically was included within that, but the current bill stands, the Lane County Board of Commissioners is in support of this bill. There are just a couple of pieces that I wanted to add on from more of a systems level with regard to this bill, and that is that this bill seeks to rectify a common misconception by adding clarity to the current ORS as it's written. I think there's a common misconception around the idea of commensurate with the public good relating to the parks and salmon restoration and education funds. And as it is written, this bill would add additional clarity to that in that we know that many people in Oregon suffer from problem gambling, and this would sort of institutionalize and add clarity to the ORS as it's written. In addition to that, this would operationalize the comprehensive responsible gambling policies in a best practice format, and that many other organizations and governments currently have in place. And one of the examples in written testimony is that of the Australian Productivity Commission, which has a very sound, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Lane County government, the sound best practice in responsible gambling guidelines. Institutionalizing a proper social responsibility effort is within the state's duty of care. This is a state-run operation, and therefore it is in the responsibility of our state to provide and protect the citizens of this state with regards to social and economic harms of problem gambling. As it stands currently, you know that we are meeting as a marketing advisory committee. There is no mandate of this committee in terms of, you know, carrying forward any kind of tasks that outcome of this is the choice of the lottery. And I think this would help truly institutionalize the Oregon Lottery's duty of care in reducing harm related to problem gambling. So thank you for the opportunity to be heard on this issue.
Thank you. Any questions of this? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would help me a little bit because as I tell people these stories, to be able to talk about, we have individual stories, and I appreciate you telling that again, Julie. That was painful, but I appreciate you telling us that. But from the county's standpoint, how is the county affected? Can you give me an example of how the county is directly affected by this by gambling. I know that there are examples, so I just want to, I'm just trying to get something on the record and something that I can, when I'm talking with people, because all of the language is very bureaucratic in this. And when I'm talking with my next door neighbor and I jumped into the commissariat with the public good, look at me and go, right. give me a good example.
Co-chairs and Representative Fregret, that's a great question. You know, typically we look at problem gambling from a systems level is really affecting a lot of social costs. We look at, you know, people that file bankruptcy, that puts an increased need on the county. Criminal justice costs put an increased need on the county. Legal fees put an increased need on the county, and so forth. So there are quite a few social costs that are related to this issue beyond just, you know, someone's personal life being affected.
And as you look at this, I would love to have Lane County sort of give an estimate on where those costs are. How much does this cost? Does this cost, if you said legal fees, each time somebody's brought in because of this particular infraction, that costs the county a certain amount of money to deal with that particular person. We had an attempt to do that in Portland at one time. Via, I think it was Volunteers of America. They decided to track what happens and how much it costs. They ended up having one person cost the county about $1 million just because of all the legal fees, the arrests, the time taken in overtime to fill out forms, to bring people in. That's the kind of thing that would be very helpful to get a sense of, to follow one person who was heavily into an addiction, and this is all. These are all the costs. It would be very helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, Representative Frederick, just really quick to that point. We do have information from a statewide level regarding all the costs of problem gambling, and that is conducted on a yearly basis by research from the, surveys from the recovering problem gamblers who've passed through treatment. And so we can get statewide figures, although it would be a little bit challenging to get county figures unless we could somehow drill down those numbers.
I would be delighted to get the state figures.
And Mr. Murphy will be able to speak to that as well.
Let me, if I may follow. The statewide figures would be helpful. Again, I think we need to be able to say this is costing, this is what's happening in terms of the county costs. A person, finding one, you don't need to have a particular name that you give out to everyone, but if you find one person who is really struggling with this, this is a treatment facility, the kinds of special programs that are necessary, mm-hmm. the kind of arrests that we are dealing with and helping this particular person. What does that cost? That would be very helpful to me.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Great question. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Well, to kind of piggyback on Representative Frederick's question, I mean, the other piece of cost that I think is hard for us to get our hands around is the cost of to the individual, like potentially crime victim. I mean, we have a lot of women tied up at Coffee Creek who have stolen somebody's ID. My sister was one of those people. Steal your ID to get cash to go and put into these machines. So, you know, that's a cost that I don't even think we're even aware of, is how much is, you know, to the financial institutions or what have you when suddenly somebody's washing checks or, you know, getting credit cards or whatever and, you know, trying to find ways to get cash back. And I learned a lot that there's a lot of ways to scam the system, you know, and whether it's turning Home Depot gift cards into cash on the street for dollars to put into them, I mean, and that's something that my sister did. And that is a real, you know, those are real crimes that affect real average everyday citizens who are, you know, caught up in this. And I don't think we have a way to track how much is happening at the retail level, at the, you know, financial institution level, and to the individual systems, people who are victims of identity theft. And I think we've got, like I said, a lot of women tied up in our Coffee Creek system who have gotten harangued into that, you know, the identity theft piece to pay for this and, you know, the sometimes the drug addiction that comes with that. So,
thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Thank you again.
Thank you. Hi, thank you. My name is Rhonda Hodafi, and I represent Oregonians for Gambling Awareness Organization. It's an organization that I founded 16 years ago, 1995, after the death of my brother. He committed suicide after his addiction to video poker. So it's my pleasure and honor to be here today. So thank you guys for offering this opportunity for us to support House Bill 4083. I've been working with this problem, like I said, since 1995, and as you said, Representative Parrish, I've learned a lot through the years, unfortunately, after my brother passed away. So what I've done in my last 16 years is I feel like it's important to educate and to get the word out about hope and help for people who are still struggling. There's been so many people that are affected from this, and I know earlier number was 67,000 gamblers in Oregon, and that's just the gambler themselves. That doesn't take into account the amount of people it affects in families and outside people. As you mentioned, there's a lot of other people who are affected by that. So I want to say a couple of things, and I am sorry for your loss, because I feel that loss and I understand what it's like to go through that. We tried in the past to get video poker out of the state of Oregon, and we were told that this casinos can only offer what the state offers, so it becomes kind of a go-around with that issue. Also, as far as the budget balancing and trying to figure out what is best for the state, how are we going to bring in the most profits and balance that with what's best for Oregonians. There's so many things to add into that with social costs, and you know, you can put a dollar amount to each of those social costs, embezzlements, theft. You know, I work in a school. We have a lot of kids who are on free and reduced lunches that wouldn't have to be otherwise if their parents weren't gambling. So, you know, like you said, the costs go on and on and on and on. There's a lot of little costs that we can count with. You know, my brother didn't pay off any of the credit cards that he had his debt on, so that's all absorbed by those financial institutions. He didn't pay his truck payment, so the truck went back to the company. So, you know, there's all those costs as well. And it just, you know, so that amount goes higher and higher as you dig deeper into each of the gambling scenarios. One of the other things that was mentioned was, I believe that you, Ms. Rep. Tomei, had said, ask why couldn't he stop, you know, the gambler that was up here earlier. What was it that kept you going back when you knew you shouldn't have been? And one of the things we learned is that gambling is a 24-hour illness. And once your mind is stuck on that gambling issue, they know they've spent their money. My brother knew he didn't have the money to go again, but he went back anyway because he had to make that money back. He had to get back the money that he had knew he shouldn't have spent. And then he had to figure out how he was going to cover the lie. How am I going to find the money? Who am I going to borrow it from this time? What did I tell him last time? Did I tell him I needed gas? I can't tell him that again. I need to tell him I need food. You know, so their mind is just this constant motion of how to do it, what to do, where to go next, you know, what kind of money to find. So it's a constant, constant thing. And we can shut off our brain at night. We can lay down and go to sleep. Bobby couldn't. And that was one of the hardest things for him, was that he just said, I just needed a break. I just needed it. I needed it to stop. I needed the noise to stop. And so that was something that was really, really hard for him. Julie mentioned a little bit about Australia, and one of the things they do have is a safety net on their video poker machines. Every 20 minutes, the machines shut down, and they give you an amount of money that you've spent in dollar amounts, not in credits, and it also gives you an amount of time that you've been there. So it tells you you've been here for 20 minutes, you have spent $300. Would you like to continue? And it makes that brain pause for just a minute to make that decision instead of sitting there for 5 or 6 hours not realizing how much time had passed. And I think that that's something that we need to look into in our state. It's just a safety net. It's just giving people an option. So thank you.
It's very helpful to hear the specifics that you're talking about here and how addictive it is. And I hope I did not say that it sounded blaming when you, and I certainly did not mean that to be blaming when I asked that question. So
I appreciated your questions, because I think it's really important that we understand what this is. I didn't understand it before my brother passed away. I didn't understand it, and I wish somebody would have had, you know, I wish I would have known what questions to ask and how to get information about it, because I think it is really important. And for me, I still don't understand how it exactly works. My brain doesn't work that way, so it's hard for me to get it. So I appreciated your questions. I appreciated them very much.
Thank you. And that's what I'm hoping that we can get in our committee hearings, because I don't understand it either. Mm-hmm. And when I go to one of these Dotties or Foxies or whatever, and I sit there and I just don't get it. So when I ask questions, it's like, I want us to understand a little bit of what that feels like, so we understand what our responsibility is, what can we do to help. Mm-hmm. But first, we have to understand the problem, and so that's what I'm hoping our hearings can do, is get personal information from either families or people who are having addiction problems to understand what that's like.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Any other questions? No, Representative, you look very puzzled.
Doug, I'm thinking the same thing you are. I don't understand. But,
yeah.
You know, I appreciate the lines of inquiry and the stories, and I guess I'm just fortunate in that I haven't encountered.
I feel that way, too, that I'm very fortunate. But I want to understand, so that I think as state legislators, we have a responsibility to try to help, at least to help mitigate some of the harm that apparently is covering. I'm not quite through. is that where you are? Okay, and Representative, we have Representative.
Actually, no, Representative right. Parrish.
Okay. You know, you brought up a really good point about, you know, what happens after somebody who it has all of this debt and they die. I mean, my sister has student loans, and the federal government's calling my house going, you know, we'd like to collect those loans. They have no estate, understand. Mm-hmm. And my so, brother. You know, the cost of everybody's higher ed just went up because she, you know, died with however many thousands of dollars in student loans left. I mean, that's the type of stuff that we can't put a cost on. And when you talk about the truck payment, you know, and the truck going back and the credit cards are, mm-hmm. all of those things drive the system, and they, you know, they incur additional cost. And again, that's something that, you know, when you said that, it snapped to it. We're still trying to convince the federal government that she passed away. We've sent the death certificate and the whole nine yards, and, you know, they're still trying to collect on an estate that's worthless. And when these folks, people are dying with, you know, $250,000, $500,000 in debt, and they've lost everything, you and I, all of us, are paying for that at the end of the day in some kind of increased cost, you know, whether it's a consumer product like a mortgage or what have you. I mean, we're shouldering the burden for that cost in so many different ways, and I appreciate you sharing that, because I wouldn't have even thought to bring that up unless, you know, you've mentioned that and it snapped me. Yeah, we're still fighting creditors.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. Hi. I'm not quite sure how to say this. We're dealing with addiction in this case, which is the same as alcohol addiction, or it's the same as heroin addiction, or it's the same as cocaine addiction. I mean, this is a chronic relapsing brain disorder. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can understand it is to understand what goes on in the brain, because this isn't about money, as I think was pointed out. This isn't about winning. It isn't about losing. It's about the pleasure centers of the brain being triggered by behavior, which in some cases, they take a shot of alcohol, or the need for heroin, or the need for cocaine. And I mean, the only way we can understand it is in terms of physiology. I mean, we see the addiction, but the addiction comes out in a variety of ways. What we've done is make this particular drug of choice easier to get to. I mean, it's as if we put heroin or cocaine or everything else in every 7-Eleven, so that people could stop in and get their heroin or their cocaine. And treating it is so complex because it is a chronic disorder, and it's one that has relapsing elements. And as the gentleman said, recovery is so hard because there's that stimulus everywhere that triggers your brain to want to go do whatever is going on there. And our problem as legislators is to deal with the fact that we're the dealers. I mean, we're the ones that are selling this product. I mean, it's as if the state decided to put an agent on every street corner and start selling cocaine to children, because we're doing exactly the same thing with the lottery. And somehow we have to figure out what our moral responsibility is in terms of of feeding this illness, because there's just no question in my mind, we're complicit in this. I'm sure if it's in person, I really have the same feeling. This is immoral, what we're doing here, and we need to figure out how to stop doing it. and to mitigate, I mean, to say to the lottery, okay, don't forget, you know, besides gathering $1 billion a year for us, we are, oh, you should also watch out about addicted people. Well, as long as we put them to work gathering $1 billion a year for us, they're going to keep doing it. And not only legally, we're instructing them to do this. What turns out to be, in my mind, a very destructive thing.
Was there a question in Representative Bremer?
No, that's the end of my story. Well, I'll be glad to share my plan for getting us unaddicted.
Great.
Can I respond
yes.
really quickly?
Yes.
I really appreciate your comments because I think that it's so true. And one of the things that I've believed for a long time is that, as was said earlier, Oregon is addicted to the money. Oregon is addicted to the funding. And until there's a replacement for that funding, nothing is really going to change. But the difference between a gambling addict and a heroin addict or an alcoholic even or anything is that you don't see the effects. And so with my brother, we didn't understand that there was a problem until the financial devastation was so hard. And as you said, it wasn't the money that he lost. I don't even know what the total amount of money that he gambled away was, but it was the self-worth and the dignity and his feeling of being a productive human being to society. He felt like he was draining society because he wasn't paying anything. He wasn't following through with what he knew he should follow through with. And so it was his guilt and his feeling of loss of self that is what took him from us. And we didn't see the effects. He wasn't an alcoholic. He wasn't a drug addict. He didn't have any other record of any type anywhere. He was someone who worked hard. He made $45,000 a year at 28 years old. He worked his way up to get where he wanted to be. So he was a productive citizen. He did a lot of good things for his community. He, you know, a great family person. But when this came into his life, those things started slowly slipping away. And we didn't recognize it as an addiction. We didn't know what it was until it was to the point that it was too overwhelming for him to find a way out.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Tim.
Representative Tomei, Representative Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Tim Murphy. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Bridgeway Recovery Services, which is a mental health and addictions treatment clinic here in Salem. We have outpatient treatment for outpatient gambling treatment, and we have the only residential gambling treatment program in the Northwest. We have folks from Oregon, Washington, and once in a while we let somebody in from Idaho. I really appreciate your interest in this bill and bringing it forward today, particularly in this session. And I really want to acknowledge, Representative Tomei, your leadership in bringing this issue constantly in front of the legislature and the community, because we do have a problem in Oregon. The gambling, the moral issue that Representative Greenlick brought up is something that you deal with, but we deal with it every day in our clinic. I have lots of data that I could give you for those of you that are interested in data, but what I really want to do is respond to Representative Frederick's question earlier about we want to understand this, and I want to invite you to come. Bridgeway is 2 miles from here. We have 10 beds dedicated to pathological gambling, folks that are living with us. I would invite you to come visit. I will set up an opportunity to talk, discuss, learn, really understand some of the devastation that's happening to your fellow citizens as a result of their addiction to gambling. It really is a compelling and overwhelming story. Not only is it a financial loss, but the loss of humanity, the loss of family, the loss for a lot of people of their future, and in really sad cases, the loss of lives. There's a high suicide comorbidity with pathological gambling, much more so than some of the other addictions. Representative Kenmar earlier this afternoon called this a tiny bill, and maybe it's a tiny bill. You've got some really big bills this session. This may be a tiny bill, but it's got really big importance, and if we could start bringing some clarity to the definition of the mission of the lottery. You know, most people who buy lottery products do so just fine, and you're right. It raises $1 billion that you allocate around the state for lots of really positive good things, but it has a significant social cost, a devastating social cost, that you really got to wrap your hands and your hearts around and devise some way to understand that and to help us treat that. Again, thank you for your attention. And any questions you may have, I'd be happy to
Tim, try. You said you have some statistics with you.
Yeah,
you don't need to repeat them now, but if you would give them to our...
Absolutely. Clerk. Be happy to do that. Yeah.
Or unless you want to cite any...
Well, I'll get them to you and get them distributed. The one thing that came up, the $469 million is the estimated annual social cost of problem gambling here in Oregon. $469 million. And we constantly can talk about incarceration rates and county rates and the cost of loss, but, you know, we talk about what we don't often include is children that are taken away from their home because their parents are sent to treatment or incarcerated as a result of gambling, how that impacts DHS and foster care, the destruction of the family, what happens, and when you hear from other on other bills regarding foster care and kids in treatment, you know, a subset of those kids are directly connected to this issue.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you all.
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I know I'm out of order, but I was wondering if I could tack on one more thing.
Say your name again.
Julie Hines, Problem Gambling Prevention Coordinator, Lane County. I was reviewing the fiscal impact statement of HB 4083 and noticed that the Lottery Commission notes that some of the activities required in this bill may not be allowable expenses of the Commission, and we would require a general fund allocation. In fact, a review of the administrative costs of the Oregon Lottery shows that they are allocated up to 16% of their total annual revenues for administrative expenses, and yet they currently only use 4%. So I wanted to note that for the members of the committee that it would likely very much not need a general fund allocation.
Thank you very much for that information. Mr. Kocher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly.
Yes.
Are you aware of counterparts to your position in other counties?
Kocher Gilliam, yes, I am. We have, depending on the day, probably about 20 of my counterparts across the state, although typically more of the efforts are based on awareness and not so much in prevention. And a lot of the folks wear many different hats. I get the fortunate ability to be able to do my job and just do problem gambling prevention in Lane County.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And the last person we have signed up to testify is Larry Nieswander. Is there anyone here who wishes to testify who did not get a chance to sign up? Put up your hand. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Good to see you again.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, Larry Nieswander, director of the Oregon Lottery. I was here approximately 3 weeks ago when this was in a legislative concept form and spoke quite extensively to you and shared some information and tried to answer most of your questions. And I am just here today to assist the committee in any way I can. There was one additional issue that came to light after my testimony that Representative Kenemer spoke to briefly, and that's just the issue of in the measure where it modifies the mission of the commission by assigning it with a statement of direction that the lottery shall actively work to balance its mission to maximize revenue while minimizing the impact of problem gambling. And that particular directive does create some risks that has come to our attention, and I just wanted to let him know that. That's why I met with him earlier today. And it does, as he described, create a risk related to a statutory duty of care that could create legal liability. And so it's just something that to be aware of. And that's all I did was to make him aware of that issue being brought to our attention. As has been testified to, the lottery does generate a significant amount of revenue for good causes for the state of Oregon, but it has tried to and continues today to try and do that in a sustainable manner, in manners that are commensurate with the public good. And when I was before you before, I outlined a number of activities that we have done and continue to do to continue to go endeavor to do that. And my commitment to you is that the lottery and the commission that I represent will continue to do that in ways that are consistent with the constitutional framework, the statutory framework, and to serve the public good. We have convened advisory groups from time to time, and as was testified to you by Mrs. Hines, she is a part of an advisory group that's working with the lottery right now to look at our marketing strategies, to look at things that we do, what areas we may be able to improve upon. That information is coming forward from that group. The commission and I will consider that, and as a part of our ongoing effort to be responsive to public perceptions and concerns. Lottery was created based on voter support for it. It still enjoys a considerable amount of public support. That's valuable to us, and we wish to do things to sustain it. And so I look forward to working with you and any interim task force that you want to work on with this. The lottery does have constitutional and statutory limitations on what it can use lottery funds for, and so that's part of what was in my earlier testimony. Things that relate to the establishment and operation of the lottery can be included in the lottery's administrative expense. Things that relate to treatment prevention, and things of that nature are outside of the funds necessary for administrative expense directly related to running a lottery, and that's why the statutory allocation to problem gambling treatment was so important. And that 1% dedication is one of the most best funded problem gambling treatment programs in the country, if not the strongest funded, and because of that statutory dedication that this legislature established.
And I think this, if I can speak with the committee and for many of us in the legislature who have been dealing with this issue, we certainly are supportive of a treatment for people who are addicted to gambling. I think one of the things we're interested in is to stop the point where people become addicted to gambling. And I'm wondering if you see that as part of your responsibility.
Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Tomei and committee members. You know, yes, the lottery does actively engage in a number of activities to train its retailers to recognize it, to make sure there's pamphlets available, to make sure that they know about the 1-800 number, the time clocks, and the credits on the machines. We look to technology to possibly help us in the future so that we could move away from anonymous play and know who the players are so that we can help them set limits and monitor their limits in their play. It hasn't allowed us to do that yet, but we look forward to opportunities to increase that, and as technology allows us to do it, we're going to explore those things. So,
you mentioned your advisory group. Is that one of the issues that you'll be working on in your advisory group?
Actually, the format of that advisory group was for allowing them to, once they knew a little bit about our background of what we do, to bring forward recommendations of where they think that we could improve or add to or be more effective in striking that very important dual mission, raising revenue commensurate with the public good. So we're soliciting that input now, and we'll...
And what I thought I heard you say is that the advisory group was working on marketing. I think what I'm hearing here is that we would like less attention to marketing and more attention to enabling people to understand at what point they may be becoming addicted and how they can stop that process.
And again, awareness and the support of a variety of people looking and watching and reporting and helping people is part of it. Lottery wants to do its role in that. And
you see that as part of your role?
We try to equip our employees and the retailers and our players with information, public information and advertising and pamphlets.
I've got to tell you, though, I've been in some of these places. I've mentioned Foxy's and Dottie's and these places. And I don't see anybody looking at those numbers or the warnings or the pamphlets. I'm wondering how effective they are, and if you're looking at seeing how effective they are.
We do research, but we're always willing to ask other questions and see what we can do to get more information on that.
I think, speaking for me, and I'm not sure for the committee, and you please let me know, I would hope that that would be part of your advisory group, that you ask them to work on that. Mm. Is that something that you'd be willing to do?
You know, we are asking them to bring forward any recommendations based on the information we provided to them, and there was no real hard and fast, this is out of bounds, that's in bounds. It's here's what we do currently. What advice or recommendations do you have where we could improve upon our marketing strategies as it relates to a variety of things, including problem gambling?
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I appreciate that you've come up here and on several occasions, and we also got you in Veterans Affairs and just have pretty much taken a thrashing. The lottery's we've just beat it up pretty good so far this session, and so I appreciate all of the information and the data and statistics and things that you've been able to put forward, and know that we've put you in a precarious position of being a generator, a revenue generator for the state, and at the same time, I know that you do recognize that we've got problems with problem gamblers in this state, and you are in a precarious spot of actually having to balance that. I'm pretty clear on the record. I'd take your whole advertising budget and put it in treatment and have no problem doing that. One of the questions I do have for you, though, is percentage of revenue that is video poker driven versus your scratch-its and your raffles and whatnot. I mean, because I think probably the majority of the people who are problem gamblers really aren't someone who buy the scratch-it ticket at the 7-Eleven or the Safeway. They've got it right there at the point of sale, and you buy one as you're getting a gallon of milk and you go home. I think it's the people who are stuffing $20 bills, one right after the other in a little dark room, trying to get the flush fever, which I know what that game is. I'm not going to say I haven't put $20 in a video poker machine in this state. So how do you reconcile, that those dollars? I mean, is it a majority of the revenue, the $1 billion that lottery is generating, coming from video poker versus scratch tickets, or what's the breakdown of that look like?
Good question.
That's true. We got Powerball and stuff.
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish. It's usually somewhere between 70-75% of the net revenue proceeds that come to the state are derived from video lottery.
Oh.
And then the remainder from the other traditional products that we sell. And yes, I believe that, as research would show, and the folks that testified before me would confirm, the video lottery is the one that probably has the most close reliance alliance with those that develop problem gambling.
Thank you.
Excellent question. Thank you. Mr. Kuchin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but if you've got a 30-second reminder for the committee, especially me, how old is a lottery, and it was by referendum or by initiative? It was by referendum. Just give us that quick thumbnail of how long we've been doing this and by what authority.
Sure. Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Gilliam. The lottery was established by a vote of the people in 1984. The vote was in November 1984. Statutes took effect in 1985, and at that time, it was a lottery, a traditional lottery only. It was in approximately 1992 where a video lottery was authorized, and so it's been operating since that time.
Did the voters vote on that, on video lottery?
The video lottery was established by the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you very much, Larry. Could you just let us know your name, please?
Yes, my name is Michael Sketch, and I am a pathological compulsive gambler in recovery. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here and to listen to the presentations of the day. Everything that is going on is legislative and situations like that. There's been some stories that have been shared, and a lot of emotions are sitting behind me. As I sat in the room, I realized that I'm very fortunate to be able to sit here and talk to you today, because I am a pathological compulsive gambler. Left to my own devices, I would probably be dead. Okay? That's no scary stuff. This is the reality of the disease. There's gentlemen that are sitting behind me that are funded, that work for Bridgeway Recovery Services, that are funded through the lottery dollars or has some percentage of that. So as I sat in the early 90s beginning my gambling career in front of the video slot terminals, that at that time were strictly video poker machines. I had no idea what I was doing to myself and to all those people that I touched. And that's what I'm trying to have you understand. It's a house bill. It's things that need to have an understanding of how things are funded and where the dollar goes. And there's many of you that are sitting there that don't understand what the problem is about gambling. It is a emotional disease and very much the pathological part, and if I was to give you the definition of a pathological compulsive gambler, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders 4 defines pathological gambling as an impulse control disorder characterized as persistent and recurrent manipulative gambling behavior. Between 1% and 3% of adults in North America fit this definition. Of those, most have some other mental health disorder. So this is a lot more than scratching a lottery ticket. I began my gambling career scratching a lottery ticket. I progressed to video poker. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for me. I am not a victim. I made those choices. But during that time, my disease grew. And because I'm emotionally unstable, only because of who I am and my esteem issues, you heard people talk about not being able to fit into society. I was a productive person in society. I was a prestigious member of many working forces. But I chose to continue to gamble, not so much for the winnings, but just for escape because I didn't like who I became. And the reality is that you can't throw money at this. You have to go out and educate and prevent the situation. A certain percentage of us will always have this disorder. I will have this disorder until the day I die. And so I am grateful to be able to share this with you. But if you sit befuddled in understanding why somebody would continue to do what doesn't make sense to anybody else. My day was spent figuring out how to do whatever I had to do to place another bet. I am grateful that I have not placed a bet since the 13th of October 2008. But that's only because I choose not to. I could walk out of this room with my disease, as I have described it, and walk over to a Dottie's, or to any of the cross-fingered, logoed locations that there's probably 200 of them on your way home tonight. But I'm not asking you to close those. I'm just asking you to understand that there are some of us that cannot gamble like normal people. And so I am grateful for Bridgeway Recovery Services for allowing me a chance to have a timeout and get the tools to learn to live again, to allow me the opportunity to rebuild what I had at one time.
Michael, what prompted you to go to Bridgeway?
Well, can I share a letter?
Sure.
I'm going to share a letter.
Well, it's not too long.
No. This is about 4 minutes, but I'll tell you exactly how I got to Bridgeway. And I'll let my daughter share how I got to Bridgeway. Does that make sense? I have a daughter that was in the year 2008 who has only known me as a pathological compulsive gambler all her life. She was born in 1992. By that time, I already discovered the video lottery machines. I was still a productive member of society. I was doing everything I was supposed to do, but I was also stopping on my way home with a $20 bill. And then I tell you, there are never enough $20 bills. So let me share. I got to Bridgeway as a result of the circumstances and the consequences of my gambling. But she had an opportunity to do a letter in her English class when she was a junior. And this is what she wrote, and hopefully you'll understand the devastation this disease has and the need to educate, and I'm talking educate in the primary school level. It is everywhere. It's on the internet. It's not just where the cross fingers are. This is from my daughter in the year, she wrote this in the year 2009. The man groggily wakes up and looks around. He notices that he's sleeping on hard concrete of a jail cell. What has happened to his life? He suddenly remembers the cha-ching, cha-ching sounds of the slot machine, and he soon realizes he has no place to turn. When his daughter finds out about what happens, she becomes angry. He really hasn't figured it out, has he? You would think by living on this earth for 53 years, you would figure out that lying, cheating, and stealing were always wrong. And what do I say to him? Can he really expect me to figure this out for him? The questions only intensify over the coming weeks for both the father and daughter. And after realizing that questioning one another or blaming her father will not help the situation, she realizes that she must step up and be the parent that her father needs. She must tell him the truth. There would be no father-daughter story to tell unless he went to get the treatment and help he needed. Thankfully, my father listened to me, and I am able to tell you of the broken, battered, and betrayed relationship that gambling addiction has caused my family and how it has impacted my view on life and my future. Last year, my father had hit rock bottom. His gambling addiction had led his life into a downward spiral. With my parents being divorced and I being their only child, a majority of the pieces were left for me to pick up. I had a difficult decision of either allowing my father in my life and pretending that the events that took place never happened, or completely cutting off all ties between him and me. Well, I'm the kind of person who never gives up in a situation, thus I made up another choice. I gave him an ultimatum. He could either choose to ignore his problem like he had in the past or get the treatment and help he needed. It took about 2 weeks for my father to finally admit he had a problem. And he realized I was serious about my ultimatum and decided to seek help in hopes of having a relationship with me one day. And throughout his treatment, I began to see small glimpses of the father I'd always wish I'd had. He began to realize there was a world outside of his and really seemed interested in my life. It may have taken him 53 years, but at least he is slowly starting to figure things out. Well, my dad's decisions have impacted almost every aspect of my life. While it's been hard, it's taught me a lot about perseverance and never giving up. And when I'm faced with a challenge now, I approach it head on and figure out a logical way to overcome it. I don't feel sorry for myself. My dad hasn't always been involved in my life as much as I would have liked, but I am thankful for all this situation has taught me. Through his addiction and downward spiral, I have learned that I have a passion for helping those who cannot help themselves. I have learned to never give up, even when things get tough. And that may just be worth more than the money that my dad gambled away and the pain that I endured.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Michael. And good luck on your recovery.
Yeah. Well, I get a daily reprieve. But it It's an insidious disease. It's waiting for me.
Thank you very
much. And it's
much.
Waiting for a lot of compulsive gamblers. Thank you.
Mr. Kocher, you have something to say?
If I could just offer a comment, and then where are we going to move on to the
yes.
next? Thank you, Madam Chair. It may be time for us to reexamine the Oregon Lottery. Voters voted almost 20 years ago. I have to say that there are a number of things that our government stands for and promotes that I abhor. There are a number of revenue mechanisms that I do not like. But I will grant you this one's different. And I want to be sure that I'm on record again with my respect and appreciation for you, Madam Chair, and your perseverance on this issue. You're an agitator. And I say that in the very best sense of that word. My first session on this committee, you chaired whatever year it was, 18, whatever it was.
98.
We had some compelling stories, probably none more compelling than what we've already heard today. I do remember a story then because the banking situation was different, and they were mailing out second mortgage offers like they were candy. Mm-hmm. And I remember the woman who came in here to say that I lost our family house mm-hmm. $200, $300 a day until my husband got the notice and thought it was a mistake and the house was gone. So I don't deny that, and I am glad we're moving forward with some kind of discussion on this. I am concerned that we go too fast or we go in a direction that hurts those that we set up to, in Representative Greenlick's nomenclature, to be the pushers of this. It is a vital part of a budget in a very tough time, and maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. So it's very important that we don't just pull the rug out on a system that a lot of people are depending on that has a great deal to do with whatever fiscal stability we have. But this is different, and I agree with you, and I want to do something about it. I think one of the problems we've talked about that didn't come up in the last two hearings was why in the world do we charge the lottery as the only agency to deal with addiction or awareness? Why would we ask them to perform two missions? So I think that needs to be examined as well. And lastly, if in fact, we'll have more discussions about this, if in fact we go the route of a task force, don't forget that if it goes to the Senate president will not sign it if it's a task force, because technically we have to reimburse those on the task force. Make sure it's a work group.
Work group.
And I look forward to some discussions and to being sensitive and compassionate, obviously, to the people that we've heard from today who are the most vulnerable, but also let's be prudent about how we move ahead in terms of our statewide addiction from a fiscal standpoint.
Thank you, Representative. Any other Representative?
Well, I think I also want us to be sensitive to the fact that I wasn't, I didn't get to vote on lottery. I wasn't, in that age group that voted on this. We've got a lot of businesses who built their business model on this model. And when we make changes, that also affects people in the system who we've essentially said go out and do this. So we also, as we walk this path, need to be very cognizant of the fact that there are businesses who have this as part of their revenue system in their business. They employ our neighbors in our community. I mean, I just think that it's a big conversation that, sadly we can't deal with in a short session, but there's all these other elements out there besides that. You've got a whole, however many hundreds of thousands of businesses that sell some kind of lottery product that we've said, put this as part of your restaurant or put this as part of your grocery store or what have you, that has these products available to them, and we need to be cognizant of the impact to them as well when we say we're going to also potentially put you all out of business if we make these changes. So we really need to be thoughtful.
Of course, there's nothing in the bill that
but as we as we start to look broader and and talk about ways to get out of the lottery or whatever, I hope that we'll also be mindful of the fact that there are businesses who we've said go forward, build your business model around this, and they have.
And we can clarify that offline, but it was meant just to for them to make enough money to be able to afford to have the lottery machine there but it was never meant to be the supporting
income. Sadly, it turned into that for, right. I think, for some folks. So.
Yes. Representative Greenlink.
Yeah, I would just like to comment. One of the interesting pieces of research that I saw had to do with what's the best predictor of success in substance abuse treatment. And one of the best predictors of success is the extent to which there's coercion in forcing people into treatment. A daughter, a family, a boss, a judge. In order to get the state into recovery or into treatment, I think somehow we need to figure out how to provide that same kind of coercion, because it's not going to be an easy thing. And it's not going to be something that you wave a magic wand and it happens tomorrow. But I think what we need to do is to get on a glide path towards getting us out, which might be 10 years or even 20 years, in the sort of way that allows us to begin to convert that money into different uses until we've got it all out of the mainline budget, and then we can figure out how to deal with all the other things, including the Indian statutes and a variety of other stuff. But
what we're hoping was to have a small step that we would take at this point, and we're not exactly sure where that's going to go. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we get ready to look at this, I think it's deeper than gambling. We're dealing with addictions here. I mean, there's alcohol, there's other things out there as well that people drive by day in and day out as well, that somebody can just pull in the convenience store and get something that disables them. And it's helping people decide where their bottom is once they get on whatever vice it is, whether it's gambling, alcohol. There's lots of the stuff that we're addicted to as far as revenue comes, and we get a lot of revenue from alcohol. So, and we won't be changing that. We've seen what happens on that as well. So I think we need to be separating the two out on how we're going to deal with the addictions epidemic in general, because we need to support the stuff that's out there, but we need to do things, help people that have destroyed their lives and help get back on their feet. Because even if we get rid of lottery, we get rid of alcohol, there's going to be some other vice that people are going to fall to. I mean, that's just the state that people get into. So I think this is a very, very big topic that we're dealing with here.
Thank you, Representative. With that, I'm going to close the hearing, and we will carry over the work session. That's all I need to do?
Great.
Thank you. And I will close the public hearing and the work session. We didn't have a work session, just closing the public hearing on House Bill 4083. Thank you for all of those who came to testify. We really appreciate it. We will be in touch with you. We will try to have some movement. It's not going to be exactly the bill that we're looking at here, but we're going to be trying to do something in this legislative session. So thank you for coming to testify. With that, I think most of you people are here for CASA. Is that correct? Am I seeing some nods? So we're going to have the first public hearing on House Bill 4082. Yes, could you tell us?
Yes, committee members in front of you, you have House Bill 4082, and it transfers authority over the court-appointed special advocates and CASA volunteer programs from the State Commission on Children and Families to the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action Service. Becomes operative May 1st, 2012. The bill also repeals provision regarding the cost of volunteer program and court-appointed special advocates on January 2nd, 2016, and declares an emergency effective upon passage. There's also a -4 amendment in your packets as well as in the back of the room. The -4 amendment stipulates that in order to be eligible, a program must be approved or sanctioned by juvenile court and have received accreditation from National CASA Association. It adds additional reporting requirements that include a recommendation that the Judicial Department, Housing and Community Services Department, and Commission study and make recommendations on the appropriate structure and operation for funding and administration of programs in the state to the Legislative Assembly no later than September 30, 2014. And then it removes the sunset that sunsets the program on January 2nd, 2016. You have received a no revenue impact statement on the -4 amendment and a fiscal statement as well, and this does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Well, we're at the end of the journey. For the record, my name is Jim Thompson, State Representative for House District 23. I can remember a while back when we took this on, we set out to find the perfect solution to the problem of what to do with CASA. I think we've made progress. I'm not certain we have the perfect solution yet, but we have something we can go with that will get us off in that direction. There's a number of things that come together with this bill that kind of, I think it realigns or refocuses our thinking about CASA, and that's long overdue. First of all, if we're going to continue to state fund them, and I'm a huge proponent of that, we need a strong state oversight for training and educating CASA volunteers. We need to be able to set a course and expectations. We need to be a partner with the process. It's a phenomenal program that I don't think we want to live without. We need to stop kicking the can down the road. I hate that term, but it applies. We need to find a permanent home for this organization. The Volunteers Commission is something like the fourth or fifth home for the agency. We need to create a permanent home, and we're not quite there yet, but we're closer. This bill directs Judiciary and the Volunteers Commission to make a joint recommendation for a new home, set one up is where we're going, and then guide it and make it work. And we have to find and spend dollars on this program. CASA volunteers are an enormous resource that we undervalue and underappreciate. Oversight, training, and education is not inexpensive anywhere we do it, but is minimal compared to the cost of poor representation in foster care cases and mismanagement in foster care cases that happens all too frequently. And also, we don't take into account the thousands of hours highly trained CASA volunteers put in for nothing. If we made this a paid agency, it would be an astronomical expense. So I'm asking that maybe we could just step up a little bit and appreciate what we have, help mold it, and help deliver a strong product. You're all aware of the fact that recently, a lawsuit was filed over things that have happened to CASA in the past here in Marion County. And we can't walk away from that, but we can build a strong future, and that's the direction that we need, and we've got to have commitment. We haven't had commitment. So I'm asking you to push this bill forward. We probably will come back in the future and look at this again and hopefully find a better funding mechanism. And I hope that if we pass this bill, you'll join me in taking it to Ways and Means and asking them to find the money to keep things rolling forward. We're not going to fund it at the extent we'd like to, but we have to fund it better than we've been doing up until now if we want to continue them as a partner. Lastly, I want to give you an example, one of thousands that happen all the time, of why we need this program. This is a current case that just came to my office. It's a little girl who's 7. She was 5 when I first met her. Not surprisingly for CASA cases, she comes from a family with problems, and the little girl has problems. She tends toward emotional outbursts. I'm not going to diagnose her situation, but I suppose problem child might suffice for the moment. She didn't have a CASA. We finally got her one. And it's a long story of all that coming together, but she was removed from her home in my district, sent to a care facility in the Eugene Springfield area where they thought they could handle her better, et cetera, et cetera. Well, anyway, we get her CASA. The CASA goes down and does a visit. Now, there's two things that come here that really bother me. Not the circumstances, but the attitude toward it. The CASA volunteer was told he couldn't see her because she was taking a nap. Okay, next question. Why is a 7-year-old taking a nap in the middle of the day? Well, she'd had another emotional outburst, so she was put in a confinement room. Now, let me just read a little bit to you here, a paragraph or so, because I think it paints a picture that we should not be proud of. Sophia, who is one of the teachers at this institution, led me to an area where she opened a door which had a peek hole in it. Behind the door was a concrete room approximately 8 feet by 6 feet in size. The room had a thin carpet on the floor, but otherwise was void of any furnishings and the light was off. At the far end of the room, I could see Jada. She was lying in a fetal position on the floor without any mattress, blanket, or pillow. I knelt on the floor at the entrance of the door in order to talk with Jada. During this time, I noticed there did not appear to be any padding under the carpet. The room was cold. Jada was standoffish, no kidding, but she also appeared to be somewhat agitated. During this time, Sophia, the attendant, asked Jada if she wanted a pillow. She then tossed one into the middle of the room. Jada scrambled on all fours to retrieve it and hurried back to the back wall. Now I can go on. Is this the treatment that we're prescribing for a 7-year-old? And we expect recovery? And this is just one of the cases that would not have had a CASA worker assigned to it. But the question I ask you, even if you want to buy into this as appropriate management, why did the institution have to say she was taking a nap? That almost implies to me they knew there was something not quite right. And I'd like to say this is only one case and it would never happen again everywhere. It happens all the time. These are the cases that we need CASAs for, and we have only a few CASAs to go around. And they tend to get assigned to cases like this where I suspected something wasn't right from reports I was getting from a grandfather. But how many other kids are subjected to this and they don't have a CASA? So I plead with you to help us move this thing forward. We've got to forget where we were in the past and find a new pathway, a new involvement on our side of the equation to get these kids adequate supervision or at least somebody checking on them. And remember, these are all volunteers. And this guy's no schmuck either. He's a former law enforcement officer and juvenile corrections officer. So I think he's probably pretty able to take a look at proper child care and ask some questions about it. But so I'm asking you to move this bill forward. There'll be others behind me, I understand, who will testify. And you know, well, let's get past the immediate problems. Let's find an overall solution and work towards something that we can be proud of, and this isn't it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Let's see if anybody has any quick questions of you. Any quick questions? Thank you so much for all the time and effort and energy you have put in on this issue, Representative. So we have 5 people, or 4. Okay. 5. Christina Olson, Charles Lukeman, a nice Spanish name. All right. Barbara Johnson. And then we've got... Okay. Okay, go ahead. Just give us your name, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Christine Olson, and I am the Polk County CASA coordinator, and I'm also a member of the Child Advocates of Oregon, and I have to state that Representative Thompson took part of my speech away. But that's okay. But my testimony is of threefold. One of it was my personal experience, much of what Representative Thompson spoke on. And also, I have with me also Steve McCarthy's testimony. He's not able to be here, but he was on the task force. And then lastly, I have a collected effort from the Child Advocates of Oregon. I would like to speak about whether CASA in Oregon needs improvement, and Representative Thompson touched on that. I'm here to express that my hope the Volunteers Commission will bring desperately needed oversight and stability to CASA. I'm thrilled to think that this House bill has the opportunity of rectifying these problems. The example that Representative Thompson just gave to you, unfortunately, is not the same across the board, and this is where we view that consistency across the state is so highly needed, and the training. The caseworker for this case actually is in this room today that Representative Thompson was talking about. His supervisor, the caseworker, his supervisor, the therapeutic foster parent, and the child's counselor did not know what was happening to this child. Nobody knew. About 2 months ago, there was a news report of this happening to a child who was in place with her biological parents. There was no state involvement. And unfortunately, this was happening to her child and she didn't know it. So ACASA, in the direction of our statute, has given us authority to look into these matters. The last comment that this CASA stated is, as a former law enforcement officer and juvenile correction officer, it is the opinion of this CASA that this type of isolation I observed should only be used with out-of-control criminals in a closed custody institution, not on a 7-year-old little girl in an elementary school. Multnomah County CASAs are not allowed unannounced visits by CASAs to the children's home. Representative Chip Shields is a foster parent and his assistant is a CASA. If you get a chance to ask him, he will tell you of his anguish as his foster kids returned to their birth mother, were re-abused, and removed from her again. He would tell you how much he wished someone had made an unannounced visit to the children after they were placed back again with mother, and how that information would have eliminated the continued trauma these children went through. CASAs are authorized to visit the child wherever the child is, including schools. This has resulted in CASA kids getting extremely valuable assistance in school from an adult who has nothing but their best interest at heart. However, a Marion County judge has made a determination that Marion County CASAs were only allowed one visit per quarter to the schools. Because there have been no state standards of procedures for all programs to be guided by, each local program is vulnerable to be influenced or instructed by others, such as DHS, a judge, a local nonprofit board member, or a director. This is especially problematic when there is such a high turnover in multiple counties. As each change of turnover, whether it's a judge or a CASA director, that can implement a new procedure. So the changes in this program are necessary. More importantly, there are areas that can be changed. Along with other members of the Child Advocates of Oregon, I have researched best practices for CASA as those that have been developed by other CASA programs across the country, and all of which have the stamp of approval from National CASA Association. Additionally, we have researched and implemented policies and training strategies that are focused on the fundamental principles of law-based child welfare and juvenile justice. And those are the three things: child well-being, sufficiency of placement, and permanency planning. We have developed funding strategies for Oregon CASA that are transparent, mirror the fiscal management of other successful Oregon systems, such as child abuse centers and relief nurseries, and that ensure that each and every state-funded CASA gets the training and support necessary to be truly effective advocate for a child in Oregon court. Even more so, these are areas that have the capacity for change. I, along with the previous Marion County CASA director, began researching other state policies that were compatible with Oregon in their roles to the courts. We took this information, added best practices and ideal models, and came up with standards, policies, trainings, and allocation formula that we believe matches exactly what the Volunteer Commission seeks in order to manifest CASA in Oregon pursuant to this bill. As I stated, Steve McCarthy wished he could be here today, and I'm going to read his words.
No, you're not.
Oh, I can't do that. Okay. Well, you have them. You
That's
have them.
Great. Yes,
okay.
You do.
I won't do that then.
Good.
Okay.
So we're going to ask you to finish up here.
Okay.
That would be great.
Okay. I think I just have two more pages.
Okay.
Okay. For too long, the Oregon CASA statute has laid ignored and unused. It offers an astonishing authority to lay people to be truly effective volunteers in a juvenile court room, advocating for what is truly best for the child. It confers on the volunteer access to privileged and private documents, the opportunity for inspection and evaluation of state actions, and immunity from liability to allow those volunteers to recognize and declare awkward, uncomfortable facts to ensure a child's interest is placed above that of the parents and that of the state. As we look forward for CASA, we are offered the opportunity to manifest and implement the statute as it was envisioned by Oregon legislature. Child Advocates of Oregon, CAO, a nonprofit Oregon corporation, offers the following recommendations to this body to assist them in understanding the scope and possibility of this magnificent program. There's an attachment attached to your document. Number one is in focusing on implementing the Oregon law regarding CASA. CASA is of the law and should be managed by legal principles. Research on both national CASA standards and practices as recommended by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges has demonstrated that best practice for CASA involves understanding what the juvenile justice system has authority to do.
Christine, you're reading from this document,
yes,
right?
Yes.
This is, I think, an 8-page document.
Okay.
You know, we have this. Because we've only got 20 minutes left,
okay,
and I have the other people here to testify. We have this, and so everybody has it in their file. They probably have it in their computer, too. So I will task them to be sure that they read this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all the work that you do. Thank you. Okay, whoever is next.
Co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Charles E. Lukanen. I retired as a circuit court judge from Polk County about 18 months ago after nearly 25 years on the bench. And I'd like to describe for you how the CASA program started and developed in Polk County, yes, Representative Thompson's district, as a basis for why this legislation is needed. In 1989, Donna Middleton was the director of the Polk County Juvenile Department. And Donna came to me as a presiding judge and convinced me that I needed to attend a presentation put on by a judge who was from the Midwest about this unique program. And he described it, and it was called Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And these court-appointed special advocates were folks who were volunteers from the community were appointed by the court to represent children in need of assistance from the child welfare system, and they had only one job. Go figure out what's in these kids' best interest and implement. They didn't have to follow any other statutory requirements, any other obligations to the system. They had one thing to look out for, and that was those kids. So we implemented the Polk County CASA program, I believe in 1989. It was funded by volunteers and really a shoestring. But we worked at it, and it worked out really well. We grew. We developed training, including court presentations, reporting standards. We continue to grow and be successful in many other counties. Had similar experiences with successes. However, now we have arrived at a position where we need more. We need to look at the CASA program statewide. This program must have consistency. When I go as a senior judge to another county, I should expect some consistency in how the program is administered in those other counties as well. We must have consistency in training, first and foremost. So the CASAs are always all doing the same thing the same way, and hopefully getting to the same result by that. We must have consistency in reporting, so that everybody knows what everybody else is doing and how they're doing it, and what those results are. We must have consistency in implementation. What works best? How do we get the most bang for our buck, if you will? We've gone well beyond the shoestring funding, which now brings us to accountability. This program must have standards that have been established through monitoring and reporting of what works best, what things cost. The legislation before you provides a framework for the necessary training, consistency, funding, accountability, and monitoring to achieve the results that we all want for our children. And in the end, we must have the security for the program and the independence of that program for the program to work and create the product that we want from it. And in my opinion, that's only available under the umbrella of the Oregon Judicial Branch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, take any questions.
Any quick questions? Thank you so much. Thanks for what you do, both of you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Johnson. I am the executive director of the CASA program in Clackamas County and was a member of the task force with Representative Thompson. And I want to acknowledge that there are staff members and CASA volunteers from across the state of Oregon, including Grant and Harney and coastal counties, who are present here today. I'm going to ask them behind me to raise their hands so that you know they're here. We're here today in support of this bill, House Bill 4082. It reflects the recommendations of the CASA task force and is the best interest of CASA programs across the state. We want to thank Representative Thompson for his assistance in helping CASA find a new home. The CASA programs in Oregon look forward to working with the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service as we continue to strengthen our network of CASA programs and work to provide a CASA volunteer for every child in Oregon who needs one. We appreciate the clarity and of the oversight that's provided in this bill, something we've not always had in the past as CASA programs. We're all willing to report in whatever way you request. We've always been willing to do that. CASA programs regularly report to funders, both private and government. We report to our donors, and we report to our community. So if you want us to come here and tell you how we're doing, we are happy to do that at any time. The Oregon CASA Network has been recognized by the National CASA Association as the state program for Oregon. And I want to point out that I don't disagree with the need for improving our standards, but we follow the National CASA standards, which were adopted into Oregon administrative rules more than a decade ago. Every CASA program in Oregon is required to be accredited by the National CASA Association every 4 years, and the Oregon CASA Network has recently added a quality assurance component to that so that they'll have additional accreditation in the off years of their National CASA requirement. For CASA training, for new volunteers, we use a curriculum that was developed by the National CASA Association and is highly respected nationwide for training volunteers. The Oregon CASA Network is working with the University of Oregon, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the program, but the Graduate School of Policy, and has a bunch of P's in it, sorry, second-year graduate students working on degrees in public administration and nonprofit certification have recently taken on a project to look at our allocation formula, look at formulas from other states, and make recommendations, which we'll be bringing back to the legislature, I'm sure, as part of our reporting. The Oregon CASA Network also recently received an almost $500,000 grant from the Ford Family Foundation that is designed to help develop and implement training for CASA directors as well as build our network and build our network capacity. And we are pleased to have the support of this private foundation. The Oregon CASA Network represents programs serving children in all 36 counties in Oregon. Last year, that was 4,628 children who were provided those services by 1,779 Oregon citizens serving as CASA volunteers. And I think it's important to note that the total funding for CASA programs, 29% comes from state general funds, and the other 71% comes from private sources in our communities. CASA is essential for the safety, well-being, and future of each child involved in the court and child welfare systems in Oregon, and we recommend that you pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all of you here who are serving as CASAs. It's just an invaluable service. Any questions? Thank you again. Thanks for coming to testify today. The last person we have would be Rick Prager and Kathleen Joy. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam. For the record, I'm Rick Prager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And to my right here is Kathleen Joy. She's the Executive Director of Oregon for the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action Services. And from this point forward, we're going to refer to them as the Oregon Volunteers. House Bill 4082, and I should mention, Madam Chair, we come today in ready to speak to the Dash 4 amendments. It is our understanding is that there is some Dash 5 amendments that are in draft that may be clarifying some additional reporting. Is that not correct?
You're probably right, but
okay.
This is a 28-day session. Everything is in flux. So
okay.
I don't know about them, but
Madam Chair, we will speak to the Dash 4 amendments until we hear that there's Dash 5. House Bill 4082 provides for the transfer of the court-appointed special advocate program to the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Services, otherwise, as we said, referred to as Oregon Volunteers. Oregon Volunteers is administered through the budget for Oregon Housing and Community Services and has been since 2001. This has been a very successful relationship over the last 11 years. Together, we have worked to promote and support AmeriCorps, volunteerism, and civic engagement in an effort to strengthen Oregon communities. Oregon Volunteers was established in accordance with the Federal National Community Service Trust Act of 1993 and receives its funding from the Corporation for National and Community Services. When the staff and commission members of the Oregon Volunteers evaluated the request from the task force to consider this transfer, it was commonly agreed that the volunteer model employed by CASA would fit within the organization's mission and would certainly complement their work in implementing the 2007 Oregon Volunteer and Service Act. Aside from the mission fit of CASA to the organization's volunteerism goals, Oregon Volunteers also bring 17 years of experience in managing complex federal grants and building capacity of nonprofit organizations. All of the work of Oregon Volunteers supports public and private entities that use service and volunteerism as a mechanism to strengthen Oregon communities. Oregon Volunteers' administrative and grant management structures are nationally recognized for their strength. In addition to the strong capacity building and oversight structures that will result from this transition, House Bill 4082 will also provide time for all the key stakeholders of CASA to develop a proposal that allows for long-term sustainability of the program, along with the permanent placement within an organization best suited to meet the desired outcomes. In order for House Bill 4082 to be successful, it will require the appropriate level of financial support for Oregon Volunteers to administer the responsibilities outlined in the bill. Currently, Oregon Volunteers has a budgeted staff of 3.5 FTE. However, recent federal reductions to the Oregon Volunteers has required cuts to an already small administrative budget. Without additional funding, Oregon Volunteers simply will not have the capacity to administer the CASA programs. Through the Dash 4 amendments of House Bill 4082, OHCS believes the responsibilities for all Oregon Volunteers has been defined much more clearly. While there is still a fiscal impact, it is greatly reduced from what was estimated in the original version of the bill. In addition, there have been greater responsibilities for training and establishing program standards assigned to the Oregon CASA network. Oregon Volunteers will provide the oversight and approval for these responsibilities while still assuring accountability through contracting, reporting, accounting, and compliance. In closing, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that we really appreciate the work of Representative Thompson as well as your committee administrator, Beth. They were great in getting with us and working through a variety of concerns that we have or had as it relates to administering this particular program. We recognize the importance of the CASA program. We think we are structured with Kathleen and her small staff, but very competent staff to be able to provide the oversight necessary. So we thank you for that work, and we would encourage your support for House Bill 4082.
Thank you. Kathleen. I'm not open up to questions because I want to pass this bill.
Well, I think that you could open it for questions because I really wasn't planning to think. For the record, I'm Kathleen Joy, the director of Oregon Volunteers.
Any quick questions for anybody here? We want to pass this. Okay, no questions. Thank you so much for coming to testify. Thanks for what you do. Thank you, all of you, for what you do. And I'm going to close the public hearing. With that, I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 4082. Mr. Co-Speaker.
Thank you for that elevation, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I accept. And
but you're Chair, one of three now.
Chair Tomei, I move to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 4082.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 4082. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Did we open a work session? I heard us close the public hearing, but I didn't
did
see
I open
you open
a work
session? Work
session. Okay. Thank you so much for that objection. I appreciate it. Open a work session on House Bill 4082. Thank you so much. Want to try it again?
I do. I'd like to go back to being co-chair and say, Madam Co-Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 4082.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 4082. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4082 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 4082 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Yes. It was referenced to -5 amendments. I don't think I have -5 amendments.
I don't have one either.
If there are -5 amendments, they would go to the Senate side.
So, just to clarify for the committee,
please.
There was some confusion in drafting. Elsie, as we all know, is working very hard, and so we had originally submitted one request for certain wording,
okay.
And then it was just a drafting error, but actually I think what I've heard is that people are comfortable with the -4s that were drafted, and that's what you have in front of you, that's what we have the paperwork, that's what's in the back of the room, and what I think the audience has been speaking to today are the -4s. So
I just didn't want to leave the impression that we're rushing this bill through to hide the -5s or something.
No.
It's not the intention.
You want this
Thank
passed,
you.
Representative?
Okay, any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Thompson got me thinking here.
No.
I thought you had the power to skip Ways and Means and just send it to the floor. Do you not, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. It's going to the floor and then it goes to Ways and
Ways
Means.
Ways and Means.
Okay.
Sorry,
well,
forget I said anything.
Yes.
It's just the odd language.
The procedure is that committees can't pass bills back and forth to each other. They have to go back to the floor and then be reassigned back to. So it's just a procedural motion that they go to the floor and then they go to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Any problem with that? All right. Representative, did I already say that he moves that it goes to the floor and then to Ways and Means by prior reference? Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Weiser.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the
Committee on as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
As amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Congratulations, Representative, and to all of you here. We have one more piece of business. Could everybody stay, please? We heard a bill last week, House Bill 4077. Directs each school district board to adopt policy regarding teen dating violence. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4077.
You did have one person
do that. I spoke.
Also has the Ways and Means.
So.
You need to speak to the amendment?
Well, you can clear a room, Madam Chair.
Would you like me to summarize the amendment,
yes,
Chair?
Yes, please.
Co-Chair Tillman and committee members. House Bill 4077, you heard the other day, you do have the Dash 1 amendment that was also in front of you at the meeting. It clarifies that dating or dating relationships do not include a casual relationship or ordinary fraternization between two parties in business or social context. You do have the Dash 1 amendment, or sorry, the no revenue impact in the fiscal statement issued on the Dash 1 amendment, and it does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So do you have it? Okay.
Sorry, no highlighting.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4077.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to the House Bill 4077. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So. Madam Chair, I find myself in a very strange but interesting situation in that I just moved to pass a bill that I am likely actually am going to vote against, and I just wanted to say this. I think that there are significant questions about personal responsibility in this. I think it is a delicate subject. I think we have to be careful about private educators in this matter, and I also think we need to be responsible about what we send to Ways and Means. Having said that out of one side of my mouth, I believe this is real. I believe it's a real problem, and I have been convinced by my other co-chair in another committee, Representative Bailey, with us today, that this is worth attention, at least a vote in this body. I've had extraordinary fraternization with him, and I respect very much the will of the committee and the interest of the committee, and that's why I think we should have a vote and move forward.
Okay, so all we're just voting on the Dash 1 amendment.
I was just trying to save you the speech at the end.
Any other discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? Any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing that, the Dash 1 amendment is adopted. Do you want to do this?
Yes.
Or want somebody else to do it?
I will be happy to do it. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4077 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 4077 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Representative.
Madam Committee Minister, did you say you do have the paperwork or you don't have the paperwork?
Yes, Representative, or Chair Tomei and Representative Greenlink, we do have the paperwork. There was a fiscal statement issued and a no revenue impact statement.
I'm sorry, that was all I misheard you.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the sponsors for bringing this forward as one of the moms on the committee with kids in public schools. I'm hopeful that our public schools at the local level will find a way to adopt this, that they'll listen with care to parents, because they're these types of things are going to get pushed back from parents about, schools aren't supposed to teach my kid things, but, I grew up in a house where the mom didn't do her job all the way. So there are families out there for whom, we've abdicated that the school district is the responsible party, sadly, for a lot of kind of the things that parents should do or used to do or never did. It's an important topic, and certainly you want to make sure that kids are safe as they go through life. And so it's just, Chris, I appreciate the sponsors bringing this forward, and hopefully we'll find a way to, mom or dad, sorry. Get a note from my neighbor here. hopefully, school districts will be thoughtful about how they actually apply this and bring parents into the conversation and use it as a good talking point with parents in their communities.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be a no vote on this for multiple reasons, but one of them is just the fact that we're mandating to every school district when it doesn't apply to every school district. I think this is something that needs to be done at the local level and handled at the local level where they see need fit. I don't think we should be mandating this on every district. I'm sure every district would like to take back a lot of mandates that we put on them at the state level and that we end up kicking ourselves for later on. So for that reason, I will be voting no on this bill, because I think it's something that the local school boards would handle and take care of just fine. So,
thank you, Representative. Representative Thompson.
Doing that tomorrow.
Well, in the theme of my esteemed colleague beside you, I recognize that this isn't the perfect bill, and it violates my long-sought position that I shall only vote for bills that are perfect. But in this particular case,
Which is the last one.
In this particular case, I think this problem has been getting kicked around long enough. We need to call attention to it. And you know, if we send it to Ways and Means and they don't find the money, then we'll kick them around. But it's too important in concept to not take action on this bill. And if we have to come back another session and tweak it, it won't be the first major or minor bill we've had to do that with. So I'm going to support this today and probably regret it sometime in the future, but we'll work on it then.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing no other discussion, the clerk will call the roll. Thank you, Kristen.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Carey.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Gillian.
No.
Co-Chair Somay.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bailey. Thank you all who came today. With that,
we are carrying over
House Bill 83 and 4084. With that, we will close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you, Christy.